First of all, I'd like to make a few remarks about the course, as it were, before anything else. This, by the way, it's not a talk upon anthropology exactly, although it is in a way, but anthropology is only one aspect. What we're dealing with is the whole spectrum of prehistory. And, of course, the overall title, as you know, is called An Introduction to the Study of Prehistory. And then there are subheadings which explain what the particular subject is going to be on each occasion. Now, they are subjects in themselves, but they're all closely integrated with the other subjects. In other words, you can't discuss anthropology, in my view, without taking all the other factors into consideration. And the title of this particular talk is General Background and the Relevance of Essentially Related Sciences, The Birth of the Earth, the Inorganic Period. You had it printed wrong in the standard, by the way. You had Organic Period, the Inorganic Period, and the beginning of life. To some people, that may have seemed to have no relevance whatsoever to socialism, but I'm going to assure you that the whole of this subject, in my view, is essential to an understanding, a greater understanding of socialism, and in particular to argue the case much more to advantage if you are aware at least of the general aspect of the whole thing. So I'll start off by saying that we're dealing with history. The word history, of course, is an all-embracing term, and it can be applied to the whole period of evolution of the Earth, or it can be extended to take into account the whole life of the universe. However, what is usually meant when using the term is the history of mankind, with the emphasis on written history. And Comrade Coleman, of course, has mentioned that there will be a class on history, and he will be dealing with that. Nevertheless, the study of mankind cannot be confined to written history. As a matter of fact, the invention of writing is a relatively late achievement in the period of human existence. Some of the earliest examples, which you no doubt know, are the stock records of Sumerian farmers, and they were engraved upon clay tablets, and this only goes back to about 5,000 years. The study of human history is therefore divided into two parts. One, the period of recorded events, and that's with the application of writing, and that's a period of about 10,000 years. That's coincidental with civilization, 10,000 years. And two, that section which is referred to as prehistory. And that's before the invention of writing. And a comprehensive study of this must take into account the whole history of the Earth, as far as it can be ascertained, from its coming into existence 4,600 million years ago. It used to be 4,500 million years, but the geologists and other scientists have added on another 100 million years, which, what's 100 million years when you're dealing with 4,500 or 600 million years? And our contribution this evening to the complete study of history, that's the whole of history, including the written history, is known as prehistory. And the consideration of this involves an appreciation of a number of separate, in a way, separate but related scientific disciplines. Now, some people and members of the party might wonder why it is that we're starting off like this. But I can assure you, from my experience of the party, in my view, they've never dealt with the question of anthropology in any comprehensive way. Any of the meetings on this subject that I've been to, that the parties run, have usually been dealing with tribal society, the basis of which was Lewis H. Morgan's Ancient Society and his other book, Consanguine, what is it? I forget exactly what it was now, but anyway, it's Lewis Henry Morgan's works, coupled, of course, with Engels' Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State. In other words, it's like pulling a rabbit out of a hat. It doesn't give a comprehensive story, and it doesn't take into account what happened before, and not very much account of the further advancements and developments that have taken place. So this is why I'm going to deal with it in this way, and as far as I know, this is the first time that it would have been dealt with in this way. You see, I can't see how you can explain the position without taking into account these other related sciences. So in order to avoid any misunderstandings which might be due to unfamiliarity with the subject, and I'm going to assume that for the purposes of the talk that you are unfamiliar with the subject, I'm going to outline what these sciences are and what their function is and how they are related. Obviously, the title gives an indication of the scope. It is an introduction to the study of prehistory. And to that extent, I will be giving you the barest of bare bones. In other words, I think that's quite an appropriate proposition, seeing that we're going to deal with old bones to some extent. And that's what I'm going to keep to. The reason for this, of course, is twofold. One, my knowledge of the subject is limited. And two, even if it weren't, if I were to try and present it in any great detail, the question of the time would make it impossible. We haven't got the time to do it, so it's going to be the barest outline, and I'm going to assume that you are unfamiliar with the subject and your degree of unfamiliarity is slightly more than mine. So, first of all, the first science which is apposite to this this field is geology, and that is the study relating to the history and development of the Earth's crust with successive formations of sedimentary rocks which have been laid down over millions of years. And the factors which led to this particular study being called geology are briefly as follows. Prior to the 17th century, the medieval Latin word geologia covered the study of everything which was regarded as being materialistic or earthy, such as law, rather than anything that was divine or to do with religion or God. And one of the earliest incidents in which the word is used in anything approaching the modern sense is in a book by a chap called M.P. Escott, and this was first published in 1657. It was written in Norwegian and translated into English in 1663 by a Daniel Collins. Well, I must confess that I've read neither book. I can't speak or read Norwegian, and I certainly haven't read the other book, and I don't know who Daniel Collins was. Nevertheless, this was the first time that it began to be written about in this way. And this book dealt with earthquakes as an introduction to the study, with qualities and properties of the earth, its wonderful and natural operations within itself, using all of the flowery language that they used in those days, as well as the minerals, metals and substances in and under and on the earth. But it wasn't until 1778 that the word geology was definitely suggested as the proper term to describe the study of Earth history, and was soon after universally adopted. Now, geology is closely associated with paleontology. You can't study or discuss paleontology without introducing geology, and vice versa. Two things go together. And paleontology, of course, is the study of the fossilized remains of plants and animals in successive strata of sedimentary rocks. Now, the word is derived from the Greek, palea meaning old, onto to be, and logos discourse. You'll find that most of the terminology that's used is predominantly Greek in origin. I don't quite know why that is, but it seems to me that one of the reasons may be that seeing that these sciences really got off the ground in Britain, first of all, or in Europe, particularly in Britain, with all the old people who use these terms. Anyway, and of course it's, to put it shortly, it's a study of old. It included minerals and rocks of all sorts, as well as flint implements, which were off as figured stones and later organized or extraneous fossils. In other words, they realized that fossils didn't grow. Incidentally, there are all sorts of weird ideas in the early days, going right back to the Renaissance, all to do with the flood and all the rest of it, and oriented towards the God idea. Very, very peculiar, and I'll tell you what books to, if you're interested, to get. It so happens, of course, that the most correct analysis during those periods was made by Leonardo da Vinci. His findings and his descriptions weren't published. They were later sold to some lord or the other, and they're in a private collection, or were up until quite recently. It was not until the 19th century the use of the name fossil for minerals was dropped entirely. And for a short time in the 18th century, the term petrifactions was current, but it was soon realized that this term was not strictly accurate, since fossils occur in various states and are not necessarily petrified. And the study of fossils as a whole, as a distinct branch of geology, was styled autisotology. And that was during the late 18th century. And it wasn't until 1834 that a Frenchman and a German paleontologists, singularly but together at the same time, as it were, something like Russell and Darwin in the same way, suggested the term paleontology. Now, the next, and for us I suppose the most important field of study in considering the history, prehistory, is the science of anthropology, which is the study of mankind. And there are two important aspects of this: physical anthropology, which emphasizes the biological characteristics, anatomical, morphological and physical, and social anthropology, which deals with behavior and lifestyle and the social history and cultural development of the species. And at this point I would like to also introduce the science of archaeology. Now, it has been mentioned in one particular book on archaeology that I read, dealing with Egypt, that archaeology and anthropology are the study of man. The only difference is that the anthropologist studies man in the present and the archaeologist studies man in the past. Well, I don't agree with that. In my view, the two are closely related, and the separation is on the basis that archaeology is more concerned with the artifacts and evidence of mankind's cultural achievements in the past, in contrast to anthropology, which is more concerned with mankind's biological and social development, past and present. So, in my view, archaeology is more confined to investigating periods like the Neolithic, or periods of civilization going back to, say, as far as 10,000 years ago. Now, there is another very, very important... That's come out. There is a very, very important science, which I'll have to touch on later on, because obviously there are going to be another 6 talks, and they're all listed, what I'm trying to achieve in these talks, and that is genetics, both Mendelian and molecular. Now, that was a subject that would have been very, very helpful to Darwin, but of course Darwin came to his conclusions without the help of genetics, and genetics is a science that has, more than anything else, validated the theory of evolution. And of course it's substantiated what Darwin, the conclusions that Darwin came to without the science of genetics, which was a handicap, which of course he didn't realize, but nevertheless it's an important factor, and I shall also so deal with that when I'm dealing with the subject of natural selection and the contribution that Darwin made, and that's a lecture, that's a talk further on. Now, throughout this study, we will be considering events and processes with an enormous time scale. And the question arises, and does always arise, particularly when you get these backwoodsmen from America, or these backwoodsmen from East Grinstead or wherever, that are all carried away with all sorts of erroneous religious ideas. You know, I mean, we're dealing with millions and millions of years. How is it that we have a time scale at all? And how is the age of different rock formations assessed? Well, there are a number of methods, and in this connection I would remind you that at the Natural History Museum there is a pamphlet on the Piltdown Man hoax. That is a hoax which was perpetrated by somebody who knew quite a lot about paleontology and geology, and fooled the official paleontologists for quite a time. And it wasn't until these methods that I'm going to explain now were introduced that the detective work that was done by one of the members of the Department of Paleontology at the British Museum of Natural History, that it came to light. And this pamphlet is very, very handy. You ought to get that and read it. It's a historical background. Very, very interesting. It shows how this hoax was brought to light. Now, there are a number of methods that are used. For example, certain minerals in some igneous rocks, and igneous rocks are fire rocks, that's the original rocks that the earth consolidated into after being in a sort of a molten mass. Igneous rocks, fire rocks, that's what they mean. And these contain uranium or thorium, which are radioactive elements. And these disintegrate at a constant rate, leaving lead as the end product, or as one of the end products. And as the rate of disintegration of these is known, it is possible, by determining the ratio of parent to daughter element in such a mineral, calculate the age of the rocks containing it. And the methods developed more recently depend on the fact that the gas argon is generated by a radioactive form of potassium, which occurs, for example, in the mineral glauconite. And I'll tell you what glauconite is after this, at the end. Anything that I mention that you want to further information, don't be afraid to ask. Well, this glauconite is a mineral, and I'll explain what that is later. And that strontium, and again in this case I shall explain what that is too. Strontium is formed by the disintegration of rubidium, which is another metal, and this is contained in micas, for example, or some micas, and the age and duration of all the main geological periods have been calculated on the basis of these methods. Now, there is another, more widely known method, the radiocarbon dating method, but this is only useful for dating organic remains up to about 70,000 years old, and in reality is the tool of the archaeologist rather than the prehistorian. Now, I'll explain how this works, roughly. The radiocarbon dating, and apart from many useful but relatively imprecise methods of dating, the more certain evidence is offered by the study of radioactive substances. Now, the atoms of these are unstable and tend to break down into atoms of other elements giving off radiations in the process. And the rates at which these processes occur follow known laws and are unaffected by external influences, so that a measurement of time can be based upon them. And by these means, interesting results have been reached, for example, in calculating the ages of the earlier divisions of geological time. Now, in applying them to the Pleistocene, and I'll explain later what that is, when we deal with, and I'll show you a chart later on, I'll explain what the Pleistocene is. The Pleistocene, as a matter of fact, is the last geological stage, with this period as part of it, where all the development, the hominid development, took place. I'll explain that later, but in using the term, I'm trying to illustrate that in applying this particular method of carbon dating to the Pleistocene period, there were two lines of investigation. One relies upon radioactive substances present in seawater and incorporated in deep sea sediments. Specimens of the sediment from the bed of the North Atlantic have been collected and their ages calculated. The correlation of the dates so obtained with phases of glaciation depends on the presence in the sediment of small single cellular organisms known as foraminifera and other organic matter. These small animals are protozoa, and I'll explain what they are later on. A more direct method is that which uses radioactive carbon-14. Now, carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope of ordinary carbon formed from atmospheric nitrogen. And as a result of the action of cosmic rays, it suffers radioactive decay, reverting slowly to nitrogen, being present in the atmosphere together with ordinary carbon. I don't know why I keep saying carbon. Both in the form of carbon dioxide, it's incorporated, obviously, in the tissues of all the living things through their metabolic or vital processes. And when an organism dies, it can no longer replenish its carbon-14 atoms. As it continues to break down, the carbon-14 previously absorbed is reduced in quantity, and the reaction proceeding at a predictable rate. So it's possible, therefore, to calculate the age of organic material from a measurement of its residual carbon-14. And radioactive carbon dating, that is, as I mentioned earlier, is confined to the last glaciation. That's a period which I'll explain later when we deal with this other question. And they are dates which rarely exceed 70,000 BC. Now, estimates of the absolute age of early cultures have been obtained from radioactive measurements of volcanic deposits contemporary with the early remains. And these measurements depend upon the radioactive decay of potassium-40 to the inert gas argon. Most igneous rocks contain potassic minerals, and with the decay of potassium-40, the gas argon slowly accumulates in the rock at a predictable rate. From measurements of the relative amounts of potassium and argon in a rock, it is therefore possible to estimate the date of formation. And the method has been used successfully to date rocks of earlier periods, but of course its extension, as I mentioned before, into the field of Pleistocene dating raises various technical problems, largely because of measuring such small quantities of argon gas. In some rocks, argon can be lost through diffusion, and the method can't be applied with equal success to all volcanic rocks. Nevertheless, these are some of the methods, the scientific methods, that are used to ascertain not only the age of the rocks, but obviously the age of the fossils that are embedded in the rocks, how when they died, how long they'd lived, and their relation to other fossils and so on. Now, there are other methods that have been used apart from these more complicated scientific methods. And with regard to the much longer periods of geological time, calculations are arrived at by analysing the sediments and estimating how long they took to lay down. An example is the chalk of the Cretaceous period of the Mesozoic era. Again, I will explain what that is when we deal with the succession of life in geological time. I might tell you that the name is derived from the word creta, the Latin word for chalk, which is the predominating rock in the upper or latter part of the system in Europe and in parts of North America and in Western Australia. Now, I don't doubt that you know that chalk is largely composed of calcium carbonate. And this is mainly broken up remains of microscopic plants, algae, called coccoliths. And it also contains minute fragments of molluscan shells. Well, you know what mollusks are. They're whelks and shellfish and animals of that kind, together with this protozoa foraminifera. And the Cretaceous period accumulated chalk probably at the rate of about 1 foot in 30,000 years. Now, in Britain, as you will observe if you look at the so-called White Cliffs of Dover, it reached a thickness of over 1,000 feet. And according to my calculations, that means that 1,000 feet was accumulated in 30 million years. Think of that, 30 million years. And the duration of the Cretaceous period was some 65,000 million years. 65 million years. What did I say, 30,000? I meant 30 million, of course. 30 million years for 1,000 feet, and the duration was 65 million years. And that was from 135 to about 70 million years ago. Now, let us, as it were, having said all that and given you some idea of the kind of subject matter, the Earth, which, as you know, is one of the nine planets which revolve around their sun, and that originated about 4,500 million years ago. And according to various theories, one of the theories, which seemed to be as good as any of the others, it possibly started as a whirling globe of hot gases. It passed through a liquid stage and then a crust solidified. And this original crust, formed through the cooling of molten matter, must have consisted of igneous rocks, such as granite, composed of a number of different minerals. And for long ages, the Earth was surrounded by a thick, steamy atmosphere. As soon as the surface became cool enough, the water evaporated, or rather the water vapor condensed as rain, producing rivers and seas, and debris from the weathering and wearing down of the original crust was spread out by rivers and deposited on the floor of the seas. And these, of course, only gradually became saline. They weren't salty to begin with. And in such a manner, the first sedimentary or stratified rocks were formed. For example, shingle beds and other rocks which hardened into conglomerates and sand into sandstones, etc. Now, I would like you to have a look at this chart. And I shall be using this once again. That's the next talk I shall be using this, and then we'll dispense with this altogether. But I would like you to look at it because it will give you some idea of the... I've got a piece of tape or something. Let me hang this up.
It'll hang on the corner of the bookshelf.
Ah, it may do, yeah. If you can all see it there, can you?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. That's not too bad. Now, in the next talk, I shall be dealing with the succession of life in geological time right up to the Quaternary. And the Quaternary, I'll explain what that is, but that contains the Pleistocene and the Holocene. That's the period, the most important period, as far as we're concerned. But for the purposes of this particular talk, I'd like you to... incidentally, that's a little out of date. That should read now 4,000. I made this about 10 years ago. This should read 4,600 million years. Now, the Precambrian period is here, and that the length of time that that took was about 4,000 million years. And you've got the Azoic, which means no life. It's the Greek for no life. And the Protozoic means new life. Now, I've got a special consideration with this because there have been discoveries which have altered to a great extent the ideas about what occurred. You see, the fact is that when Darwin was trying to validate his ideas, he couldn't find any fossils in the Precambrian rocks. But, of course, that has been drastically altered, and I'll explain what that is. But nevertheless, can I explain that this period is a period that I'm going to deal with this evening. The other periods are divided into the Paleozoic, which means old, the Mesozoic, which is middle, which means the middle period, and the Cainozoic, which is the, you might say, is the modern period. And each era is divided up into periods. And they all have a name, and they all have their own fossils and so on. So we'll deal with that later. The early geographical conditions that you must visualize in the Precambrian were barren landscapes, mountains, deserts and volcanoes, lava fields. And before Cambrian times, there were at least 9 periods of earth movements during which mountain ranges were slowly raised up and long intervening periods when the older ranges were worn down. There were also ice ages and so on. Not that that's going to concern us very much, because the principal consideration about ice ages comes up into the Quaternary, and we'll deal with that later. There was no free oxygen in that period. Free oxygen, and there's quite a controversy going on about this free oxygen, but it was obviously released by organisms that were able to absorb carbon and other minerals and exude oxygen. Now, in relation to the Cambrian period, we have some special biological notes. Now, as I said before, it was thought that along a large part of that period, the Azoic period, was without life. But with the advance of new techniques, there is a science micro-paleontology, in which they have, the scientists investigating this, have discovered various simple celled forms of life which extend the period of life from 600 years, or shall we say 1,600 years, that's taking into account the Protozoic period and all this period. They have discovered that, which extends the period of life to some 3,000 million years. So apparently life in one form or the other has been present on the Earth for about 3,600 million years. Now, what they've discovered is this, that the earliest form of life was a small cell without a nucleus, which is termed a prokaryote cell. And those prokaryote cells were instrumental, it is believed, by some of the scientists, not all, but it's believed that they were able to transform some of the minerals into free oxygen. Now, for about 3,000 million years, that form of life stagnated, because I don't know whether you're aware, but the whole process of natural selection and the development of evolution is based upon the fact that the development of life is based upon sexual development, with the cells, which are called eukaryote cells, which contain a nucleus. And on that nucleus, you have in that nucleus you have chromosomes which separate, and we'll explain later what the process is. And that has been the way in which life developed. Now, why it should be, what caused the sudden change from prokaryote cells, which were simple organisms which reproduced by simple cell division, and the creation of multicellular organisms and more complicated organisms, even although they were single-celled organisms with a nucleus, is not known. But it's obvious that it was something that occurred that could only occur once. In other words, evolution is not going to happen anymore. It's not going to happen again. The factors which gave rise to the coming into being of life were specific events which could only occur with all of the factors which were necessary, and only occurred at one particular period, because the Earth in its development, of course, was going through complete geological change the whole time. And the inorganic period, or what used to be regarded as the inorganic period, is now a much shorter period. And of course, this does make a hell of a lot of difference when we are considering how life started and all the rest of it. Because obviously, when Darwin put forward his idea of evolution, and it was later on substantiated, modern physicists and others, particularly those who are concerned with perpetuating the present economic system, seeing that they had their gods destroyed, have been looking around for other kinds of hobgoblins and so on, and they've suggested, of course, that there must be, and this is a mathematical calculation, that there must be other forms of life in the universe. But as far as I'm concerned, from my reading of it, I take the view, and I'm making a rather rash statement, but I'm still going to make it, I take the view that the working class, although they've lost their gods, it's no good looking for some highly intellectual creeps from outer space to land on the earth and overcome their problems for them. I don't think that's going to happen. I take the view, my own view, and I'm not a scientist, but I take the view from what I can read and calculate, that in all probability, we are the only intelligent life in the universe. And all this nonsense about people of different intelligences are way out there that are coming in fine sources and all the rest of it, to me, is a lot of wishful thinking. However, that's only my own particular idea. So that's about as far as we're going to go, I think, in relation to this talk, unless, of course, you want to go on any further. But I would suggest that perhaps we could have questions on what has been said already. I don't know what you think about that.
If I understand it, you've covered about 1,500 million years so far.
Well,
the fact is this,
that in a subject like this, it's very, very difficult to know how to plan it, because I can assure you that there are quite a number of very, very well-produced books, particularly upon social anthropology, with regard, for example, to the American School of Anthropology. There are excellent works, but all of them have to deal with all this stuff that we've been dealing with this evening as a preliminary introduction, because you can't really deal with the other questions without having some knowledge of that. I think that you've got to have a fairly comprehensive understanding of the whole process, and I don't think these talks are intended that we should go into any great detail. I would think that the purposes of these talks is to deal with the particular subject as comprehensively as possible, and encourage people to take up their own study. And it is a fascinating study. I would like to recommend, by the way, that in relation to the geological development, there is an excellent exhibition at the Geological Museum in South Kensington, which I very much recommend there. And there are certain publications that you can buy, although, quite frankly, it seems to me that the stuff that you can buy in the Geological Museum are more academic and are inclined to be for advanced students, more than the similar kinds of works that you get in the Natural History Museum. I also suggest that you go into the Natural History Museum, where there is another excellent, or shall I say, was, or it still is, an excellent exhibition upon evolution and the development of mankind, which has been revamped, not to my liking, because when they first erected it, put it together, would be about some 8 or 9 years ago, and they've since revamped it. At that time, when you went into the front entrance, there was a mammoth or an elephant in the front, and this whole of this exhibition was around to your right, and the book department was in a sedate little corner with not many customers. When you go through the main gates now of the Natural History Museum, it's like coming through the metaphorical gates of Hyde Park on a Sunday morning, because you are confronted first of all with the nonsense department, and you have to go further on before you can come to an SPGB meeting where you can get some bloody sense being spoken. And unfortunately, the way they've revamped this exhibition, they've taken all the more spectacular fossils, the fossils of the Mesozoic era, which we'll deal with later, Diplodocus and Tyrannosaurus and so on, all of these spectacular fossils, and planted them right in the middle in the entrance hall. And the book department is all of a mix-up. You've got a lot of children running around buying plastic models of dinosaurs, and they're in charge of adult children who ought to know better, and all of the nonsense is mixed up with the more serious works. And the most important fossils, as a matter of fact, of the Mesozoic era are still there, away in the body of the museum. And when you go there, you won't find many people. You're practically deserted. Or all of the interest seems to be centered on this sort of fairground that they've erected. Quite out of keeping, as a matter of fact, with the Victorian sedateness, although I don't favour very much the Victorian period, but nevertheless, one did appreciate the Victorian attitude in that context to some extent. But nevertheless, it's well worth going to see.